Thank you. Please be seated. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Texas State Bank versus Amaro.
May it please the court, Ms. Lisa Powell will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Lisa Powell, and along with Gary Gerwitz, I am here representing Texas State Bank petitioner. We are here today in connection with a trust that was created in 1989 by the 206 District Court.
Ms. Powell, let me ask you, are claims against a trustee for mismanagement, tort claims against a trustee for mismanagement of the corpus of the trust, compulsory counterclaims to an accounting and an action to terminate the trust?
Yes, I believe that they are.
What authority do you have for that? Do you have any cases that you can give us?
In terms of specific case law relating to compulsory counterclaim, no, Your Honor.
But okay, then can you explain why you would take that position and why they're compulsory counterclaims?
First of all, Your Honor, the accounting and the authority of a trial court in connection with accounting allows the trial court to surcharge a trustee, which according to the definition in Blacks that we provided in our brief, basically means a penalty to a trustee for in some way being negligent or in some way misapplying his fiduciary duties.
Counsel, could you pull the microphone a little bit closer?
Thank you.
Okay. In addition, Your Honor, the case that we cited in the brief is the Cobble Wall case in 93 out of San Antonio. And in that case, it dealt with the issue of res judicata rather than compulsory counterclaims, but I think that the issues are somewhat similar. And in that case, the probate court's approval of an estate plan and of a final accounting, they were both involved in that suit, was held to bar a suit by a successor administrator against an initial administrator alleging negligence, DTPA, breach of fiduciary duty, and misrepresentation.
Let me ask you something. I understand that the court can assess a surcharge against the trustee for mismanagement, which would increase the amount of the corpus of the trust that would then be paid to the beneficiary at that point in time. But in a final accounting, if the court then terminates the trust and the corpus of the trust is then conveyed to the beneficiary, that's the least the beneficiary is going to get. Isn't the claim against the trustee for breach of fiduciary duty or some other tort, isn't that then separate since it doesn't actually affect the corpus because we're looking at increasing the amount that would be paid to the beneficiary? Do you see what I mean?
Your Honor, I think we're talking about shades of the same thing,
okay.
However, because whether you call it a surcharge, which again would in some way be additional compensation to the beneficiary, or whether you call it damages for breach of fiduciary duty, either way, they are methods by which the trustee can be in some fashion penalized or subject to damages for negligence or for breaching his fiduciary duty.
Can an accounting be tried to a jury, or is it always tried to the court?
Your Honor, I don't know that there is anything specific in the Texas Probate Code that addresses the issue. I am not aware of any authority that indicates that would be tried to a jury.
If an accounting is put at issue with the trial court and the beneficiary of the trust files counterclaims against the trustee for breach of fiduciary duty or other tort claims, then would the entirety of that matter be tried to the jury, including the accounting? Or would the resolution of the tort claims occur with a jury trial and then the court would take those into account in actually doing the final accounting? How would that work?
I am not aware of any court decision that specifically addresses that issue. In general, however, where you have cases that issues that might go to a jury along with those that are generally tried to the court, there would be two different determinations, and I would suspect that would be the case in this particular case.
Why wasn't Mr. Vargas entitled to 45 days notice?
I'm sorry, I did not hear the
question. Why wasn't Mr. Vargas entitled to 45 days notice?
I don't believe that he was entitled to notice, Your Honor.
Why?
Because, to begin with, Your Honor, I'm not aware of anything or any indication that this particular exercise of the trial court's continuing jurisdiction would be a trial within the meaning of Rule 245. And in addition, Your Honor, the most important factor is that it is Mr. Vargas who set this particular hearing, not Texas State Bank. The relief requested by Mr. Vargas dealt with whether or not he regained capacity and the corollary termination of the trust. The relief requested by Texas State Bank similarly was intertwined with that. All of this dealt with the termination of the trust, and things that needed to be reviewed at that time, including the accounting. So all that Texas State Bank did was when they received notice that Mr. Vargas had set his motion for a particular date, the Texas State Bank then immediately set its own relief for the same time period. And again, we believe that all of this was interconnected and all needed to be handled at the same time. I might add that Mr. Vargas did not file a motion for continuance prior to the time that evidence was heard.
But he did object to the trial setting.
There was a very general objection to the trial setting. That is correct. But again, he went forward on his own relief. And I don't see that one can be a trial without the other being a trial. To the extent that they both involve issues relating to the termination of the trust, it seems to me like that they are of equal jurisdictional and judicial importance. And if one of them is a trial, then I would submit to you both are. But again, I am not aware of any authority that would indicate this particular exercise of jurisdiction on the part of the trial court, exercising the trial court's continuing jurisdiction, would be a trial within the context of
the trial. But it strikes me that Justice Hankinson's question kind of goes to the heart of the problem, and that is, if a tort claim for mismanagement or breach of fiduciary duty is a compulsory counterclaim in an accounting, then I can see how your argument has merit. If it is not a compulsory counterclaim, and these in fact are two different animals, then what is wrong with allowing the plaintiff to choose the forum to bring those tort claims?
Well, Your Honor, I think the easy answer to the question is that it would have been a compulsory counterclaim. Again, compulsory counterclaims are generally dealing with things that relate to the same subject matter, and I believe that that is exactly what we have here. We have a situation where Texas State Bank has requested approval of its accounting, and in the Cobble Law case that we've cited, that was held to bar subsequent claims of breach of fiduciary duty.
Okay, but let me get back to my question. And I don't recall that the briefing much focuses on the compulsory counterclaim aspect of it. If, in fact, it does not fit the definition of a compulsory counterclaim, would you agree that there be no problem then with letting the plaintiff go choose their choice of forum to try the tort claims to a jury?
Your Honor, I disagree with the premise, but in addition, Your Honor, I think that the trial court, I don't think that necessarily addresses the issue of whether or not the trial court had the authority to issue the declaratory judgment that it issued. I think that is the main issue.
But we're really talking about choice of forum, not jurisdiction. If you assume with me that those are two different animals, again, if it is a compulsory counterclaim, I think you've got a whole different issue. But if, in fact, it's not and they are two different animals, you've got two courts with jurisdiction, then why shouldn't we let the plaintiff, under our jurisprudence, go ahead and choose the form on those unrelated
claims? Policy-wise, I think that there's a couple of different answers to
that. Well, but then we're into policy, you'd say. I mean, there's nothing that would prevent the plaintiff from going into the other court other than judicial economy or things like that. I mean, it seems to me those policy choices would come into play in defining it as a compulsory counterclaim or not. And if those policy decisions did not cause it to be a compulsory counterclaim, then there would be nothing wrong and would come under, what is it, Ivor versus Smith versus Black that would allow the plaintiff to choose their form.
Yes, but I don't think that Ivor versus Black is applicable here for a couple of reasons. First of all, there are specific provisions of the Declaratory Judgment Act that were not at issue here. And second of all, the plaintiff here did choose the forum. It was Mr. Vargas who actually filed a suit in the 206. It is not Texas State Bank that chose the forum here. Texas State Bank merely asked that court that created the trust and that made it a trustee to exercise all of the determinations required of it in connection with
okay,
the termination.
And let
trust.
Me just follow up on that if we're going to talk about practical matters. Mr. Vargas chose that forum for his lawsuit. Sometimes I know trial judges will appoint trustees who are friends of the court, someone they know in the community. Aren't they going to be reluctant then to try a case for negligence or mismanagement against their appointed person? I mean, would that be some reason why they might want another forum for mismanagement of trust issues?
I certainly don't think that there's any indication of that in this case.
No,
in addition, Your Honor, I don't believe that the statutes involved here, specifically Section 142, under which this trust was created, would provide for that, because Section 142.005, I believe, and the rest of Chapter 142, clearly contemplate continuing jurisdiction by the court that created the trust. And 142.005, of course, contemplates that the court or the parties may select a particular trustee. In this case, my inclination, my belief is that it was by agreement of the parties. Texas State Bank agreed to do this, but it was not a choice by the trial court, so far as I'm aware. 142 makes repeated references to the court and actions that the court, again, the court creating the trust, would have to take. Section 142.002, for example, talks about management by a bonded manager, and 142.005 talks about the trust being amended and modified or revoked by the court. That, along with Section 115 of the Probate Code, which again contemplates the general district court jurisdictions of a trust, and I think you do need to read those together, although independently I think they support jurisdiction here. But certainly if you read them together, it appears to me that they support the jurisdiction asserted by the trial court in this instance. After all, we are talking about a trust that was created at the request of Mr. Vargas by the 206 District Court, that was funded and where Texas State Bank agreed to be the trustee, where both Mr. Vargas and the bank took advantage of the continuing jurisdiction of the court in terms of having fees approved and obtaining disbursements. And where Mr. Vargas himself went into the 206 District Court and requested termination of the trust. And bear in mind that he still had affirmative pleadings at the time of the judgment that requested that the trust be terminated and that the proceeds be provided to him. So it was not merely Texas State Bank that got relief here. It was also Mr. Vargas. Mr. Vargas requested that relief, and as a result of that request, Mr. Vargas received directly, as opposed to being in his trust, some $4.5 million. In this connection, Your Honor, I certainly think that both the policy arguments and the practicalities suggest that this is a situation where the 206 District Court was the best court in order to review the situation. It is the court that had created the trust, supervised the trust, and furthermore, it is the court that was not chosen by Texas State Bank. It is the court that was chosen by Mr. Vargas, both in terms of his initial lawsuit and in terms of the additional relief sought. In connection with the issue of the Declaratory Judgments Act, I would like to cite the court to an additional case that is not cited in our brief, and I have provided the citation in a brief letter, and that is Crosley versus Staley out of the Amarillo court, no petition, which again, along with the Trinity
what's
Universal...
What's the Southwest report?
It is 988 Southwest 2nd, 791, Amarillo, 1999, and along with Trinity Universal, talks about the distinction between a declaratory judgment case involving a contract or a trust and those in the bulk of the other situations that ABOR would address. In addition, there is a Fifth Circuit case, Sarianos versus Standard Marine, which is a 12 Fed 3rd 461, that again holds that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in entertaining an insurance request for declaration of non-liability to the plaintiffs, despite the plaintiffs' announced intent to sue the insurer in state court, again saying the plaintiffs chose the forum. So in connection with the policy arguments here and the practicalities of the situation here, I think this is a situation where the trial court did the right thing and did issue the relief that was within its jurisdiction and properly requested.
Well, what are we to do with the fact that the trial court granted more relief than was requested by TSB?
Your Honor, I would, first of all, I would disagree. I believe that the scope of the pleadings, although they certainly could have been broader without question. The pleadings requested by Texas State did in fact request an approval of its accounting and other approval of other administrative and refers specifically to administrative matters and contains a general prayer for relief. And again, I don't believe that there were objections to that. But clearly the pleading could have been more broadly, but I believe it is sufficient to cover the relief requested.
Any other questions?
If there are no questions.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Russell Post will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, the jurisdictional issues in this case certainly appear complicated. We believe that there are answers that are satisfactory to the jurisdictional...
Are the tort claims compulsory counterclaims to the action for an accounting?
Your Honor, it's not clear to me that they are. And what I would say...
Why don't they, under Rule 97, arise from the same transaction or occurrence? That's the subject matter of the suit.
I think they do arise from the same transaction or occurrence. but they were the subject of a pending action. That is our lawsuit filed in the 93rd District Court, which we had a right to file under a board.
Well, but that's not the answer. My question is, then are you saying that they're if it does arise from the same transaction or occurrence, that in fact they are compulsory counterclaims?
Well, I suppose I ought to qualify the answer that they're the subject of the same transaction or occurrence. It's not clear to me that an accounting arises from the same transaction as the claims of mismanagement or breach of fiduciary duty. Now, I'll be candid.
Well, isn't the transaction the trust and the management of the trust?
That may be, Your Honor.
All right, if that's the case, then why don't tort claims arising out of that management of the trust constitute a compulsory counterclaim because they arise out of the same transaction or occurrence?
They might, as a general matter, if all you were looking at was Rule 97.8. But I would answer in two respects. First, ABOR is an exception to the ordinary rules of where claims have to be brought. And to allow a defendant
That's a different issue in terms of the court choosing to exercise its discretion. Exercising its discretion to exercise jurisdiction or not. But if we have a trustee, in this particular instance, let me tell you where I'm going. Mr. Vargas made a demand upon the bank that the bank turn over the corpus of the trust to him because he believed that he was then competent, so the basis for the establishment of and continuance of the trust was gone.
Yes.
And the bank, as I understand it, says we find ourselves in a position of being under the continuing jurisdiction of the 206 and having to report into that court for its actions with respect to managing the trust on behalf of Mr. Vargas. So the bank files an interpleader action, if I'm not mistaken, in the 206 and asks the help of the 206 in resolving the question of whether or not the trust should be terminated.
Correct.
And you don't think there's anything improper about them having done that?
I agree there's nothing improper about asking for the court to determine if the trust
has terminated. Okay, so if that's the case, then we don't have the kind of racing to the courthouse issue that occurred in ABOR.
Well, not at that point, you
okay,
don't.
Okay, we don't have that. And so once they file with the 206 requesting an accounting and a determination from the court on whether or not the trust should be terminated, then why didn't the compulsory counterclaim rule at that point in time require Mr. Vargas to file his tort claims as counterclaims to the accounting and termination action in the 206?
Okay.
That's my point.
Fair enough, and two answers. The first answer is one element of the compulsory counterclaim rule is the claim has to be properly within the jurisdiction of the court. And our position is that ABOR is a jurisdictional rule that says you cannot fix a plaintiff's choice of form.
But ABOR says the court had jurisdiction, it just shouldn't have exercised it.
Correct. That's correct.
Well, and you're not saying the 206 wouldn't have had jurisdiction over the tort claims, are you?
No, that's correct. It would have had jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, I'll let you finish.
Well, but are you entitled to pick your judge?
Well, Your Honor, we didn't
pick... All the forums are in the same county, aren't they?
We didn't pick the judge. The case was randomly assigned.
And that was going to be my point under ABOR. Your place is Hidalgo County, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you didn't pick either the 93rd or the 206. That was done when the time of filing and was routinely assigned, correct?
That's absolutely correct.
So how was ABOR violated in that respect?
Well, Your Honor, ABOR says not that we get to go pick our judge. It says we can't be forced to litigate in the court and at the time that the defendant wants to impose.
Okay, so if we've given up on the place argument, let's focus on time. Hadn't Mr. Vargas already sent a demand letter?
We had sent a demand letter, that's right, that indicated that we were preparing to file suit. But
immediately?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. But under ABOR, we were not obligated to then litigate in the forum chosen by Texas State Bank. And I would point out to the court, whole fight could be resolved by the local transfer rules of Hidalgo County that would have allowed Texas State Bank, would still allow Texas State Bank to go to the 93rd District Court properly submitting the jurisdiction under ABOR.
But the alleged evil that ABOR was discussing was forum selection. A county in East Texas versus a county in West Texas, or a county in North Texas versus a county in South Texas. We're talking about the same county.
Well, Your Honor.
In a circumstance in which we are looking at a requirement of random filings within a county. You don't get to go into the county and say, thank you very much, I'll take this district court. So I'm a little bit confused about why the policy reasons that the court stated in Abor are even implicated in this case.
Well, Your Honor, I would direct you respectfully to the suggestion made by Justice O'Neill. And I don't want to push this too far, but I think it's not simply a policy of choosing forums in an abstract sense in Abor. I think we have a right to say we don't want to litigate in the forum, in the court, that the defendant wants to litigate this claim. There are good reasons that on occasion
why weren't those claims properly joined under Rule 51 with claims you already had pending in that very court?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why wasn't it that your claims were already pending in the court?
In the 206.
In the 206.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the bank's claims were properly joined under Rule 51. Why shouldn't you have to have moved, well, no, I want my claim severed from the 93rd, or this entire thing moved to the 93rd?
Well, Your Honor, I think we did that. I mean, we made repeated objections.
After the fact.
Well, Your Honor, we made objections. We filed objections to the declaratory judgment motion on the morning of the
hearing. But why would any court be required to transfer out of, once it had jurisdiction, why would it be required to transfer to any other court in the same county?
Well, Your Honor, I would simply say...
What rule says you get to pick which trial judge you want?
Well, Your Honor, no rule says that I get to pick which trial judge I want, nor that they get to pick which trial judge they want.
Well,
we
what
didn't
about
pick a judge. They did.
Counsel,
yes,
what about
Honor.
The rule that if the court has continuing jurisdiction of the trust that your client started, that that's the proper court to litigate the trust and its closing?
I think
he was there two or three times asking.
That's an excellent question, Justice Baker, because I'm aware of no rule that says that.
Says what?
No statute says that a court that has created a trust has continuing jurisdiction over tort claims against the trustee. And that's, in effect, what Texas State Bank is asking the court to do, is enact a mandatory venue provision over future tort claims against
the trustee. You can't argue venue in this case. Everybody's in the same county. Absolutely, this is not a venue question.
But, Your Honor, my point is that there is no rule, there is no statute anywhere that says the court that creates a trust maintains continuing and exclusive jurisdiction.
Wasn't that what Texas Property Code Section 115 says?
Yeah.
The district court has original and exclusive jurisdiction over all proceedings concerning trust, including proceedings that determine the powers, responsibilities, mm-hmm. duties, and liabilities of a trustee. How do you handle that?
Your Honor, that provision refers to something very different. And if the court will indulge me for a moment, I need to do a little history to explain that. And I apologize, this was not well explained in the brief, so I want to rectify it today. That language about exclusive jurisdiction does not refer to a particular court that has created a trust. It refers to excluding concurrent jurisdiction from other tiers of the judicial hierarchy. And it came into being to overrule a decision by this court called Weatherly versus Byrd, a 1978 decision. It's not cited in the briefs, but it's published at 566 Southwest 2nd, 292. And in that case, the question was whether a probate court had jurisdiction to declare a trust terminated. The statute at that time simply said the district court has original jurisdiction. And this court said that language means the district court's jurisdiction is exclusive and consequently held the probate court couldn't exercise jurisdiction. Now the legislature then amended the statute to overrule Weatherly, and it amended it by adding the language in Section A that you refer to, that it will have exclusive jurisdiction except as provided by a new paragraph, Section D, which says except there will be concurrent jurisdiction with the statutory probate court. And so the history of the statute illustrates that it was not intended at all to say that a court that has created a trust is going to maintain exclusive jurisdiction over any future claim. It's simply intended to eliminate the possibility of concurrent jurisdiction as to any levels of the judicial hierarchy other than the probate courts. And consistent with that, I would point to the venue provisions of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me ask you this. Once Mr. Vargas made a claim to the bank to terminate the trust and pay him the proceeds of the trust, was the bank required to go back to the 206 to get a determination as to whether or not the trust should be terminated? Is that the appropriate court, or should they have gone someplace else? Or were they required to go to the 206?
I think they were required. I'm not...
Okay, and
certainly would say they were entitled to go to the...
Well, I mean, since and they cite various statutory provisions as well as the language of the original trust document that said that the court would have continuing jurisdiction. So you would agree that they were required to go there in order to resolve this
right.
issue of whether they should be paying out the proceeds of the trust.
Right, for that limited purpose.
Okay. Then let me ask you another question about the court's order that was entered in the 206 terminating the trust and ordering that the proceeds
yes.
be paid out. The court made probably four or five findings about the trustee having properly and appropriately administered the trust, that the investment philosophy was complied with the law, that all the distributions were appropriate, and that all the fees paid were reasonable and necessary.
Yes.
Were all of those findings required either under the trust documents originally and the court's original orders as well as statutory provisions in Texas law in order for the court to properly terminate the trust? Were those necessary findings?
I'm not aware of any authority that says they were necessary findings. I think that they were just excessive requests for basically collateral estoppel by Texas State Bank, to which we
okay, so in a final accounting of a trust, there is no requirement that the trial court make any particular findings about how the trustee has managed the account. For example, is there a requirement that in terms of paying fees having been paid or requested at the time of the final accounting, that any determination be made about the way in which the trustee has managed the account?
I'm not aware
okay.
of a requirement. And let me add to that a point that I think is important both for understanding the effect of this accounting and for the question about compulsory counterclaims. Because the arguments that are made here that the accounting precludes the tort claims, or that because these were compulsory counterclaims, the tort claims can't be brought, are not arguments that can properly be decided in this case. Those are defensive matters that have to be asserted in the tort suit in the 93rd District Court. The only question in this case was whether the District Court had the right to declare non-liability for the trustee. Now, if they want to take the judgment from this case and go to the 93rd District Court and set it up as a plea and bar and say, we have an affirmative defense that bars these tort claims, they have the right to do that, and we will then have the right to litigate whether that is an effective bar, but it's premature now.
Well, it's not premature if you've appealed from that court's order challenging what the trial court did. Why isn't that issue joined?
Well, Your Honor, because...
I mean, you're making all kinds of challenges. You didn't have 45 days notice. I mean, as I understand it, you're trying to avoid this order from the preclusive effect, from there being any preclusive effect attached to this order.
Well, that's certainly too.
So if that's the case, why isn't issue joined just in a different way?
Well, the issue may be raised in a different way, but in order to assert the argument that the accounting forecloses or that these claims were compulsory counterclaims that foreclose a future case, that's a res judicata defense that can only be ruled on to foreclose the 93rd court in that case under Rule 94 and Rule 97A. And I might point out that those are going to be subject to defenses.
But the issue of either joinder, as Justice Owen has pointed out, or compulsory counterclaims is important to addressing the ABOR argument that you have raised, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully think that using those arguments to address ABOR gets the question backward. If you were to say, by virtue of a compulsory counterclaim, the ABOR rule that we have the right to choose the time and place of suit is defeated, you've swallowed ABOR for this kind of case.
And ABOR is a different case on its facts, isn't it?
ABOR has different facts, but I think the policy applies.
Well, let me ask you about
yes,
the policy. On the policy in ABOR is to not force the plaintiff's hand when there was not any other statutory mechanism for determining how the race to the courthouse works. And if there's a tort claim out there and the parties are fighting over the tort claim, it seemed the court just opted for the rule that the plaintiff's hand should not be forced, either in the selection of the forum or in the timing. Now, if the parties are already involved in litigation, if the parties are already in a lawsuit, and in this case it's a trust that's created and there's a court that has oversight, and the fight between the parties is over how the trustee that was appointed to the court is managing the case, what is there about the policy that would really permit an appellate court to come in and say, trial court, we're just not going to let you resolve those disputes. We're going to say that even though you're involved in a dispute, even though you're involved in a related matter, even though the litigation is already ongoing, even though the trial's there and the parties are there, we have this policy that overrides even the underpinnings that even came with the policy. Now just blindly enforce the policy, the plaintiff gets to pick the case they want to go to, even though the basis for the ABOR policies don't exist.
Right. Two answers, Your Honor, that it would fix the forum. The trustee is supposed to be looking out for the best interest of the beneficiary. Under Johnson v. Peckham, this trustee is supposed to not take advantage of any strained relationships to try and work to its advantage to the expense of the beneficiary. And yet that is exactly what the trustee's done here by trying to get a preemptive declaratory judgment motion. And so I think the policy of ABOR, if anything, applies even more strongly in this kind of case. And I will tell the court, I have read all the annotations from the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act. I've done a 50-state search. I can't find a case anywhere that says a trustee has the right to go and get a preemptive declaration of non-liability on a beneficiary's court.
Let me ask you, what is an account? I mean, what are we talking about here? Is there any statute that defines what an accounting is? Is it just a simple statement? Up here was the principle at the beginning of the trust. Here's what we've done. I mean, the accountings that I saw in the trial court were very simple, one-page things. Here's what's happened to the account, done, signed, that was it. Or are there prerequisites for an accounting that you have to, the trial court then has to bless everything that the trustee did? That was not my impression.
Your Honor, that's not my impression either. And that's why we would submit that the accounting doesn't necessarily foreclose.
So let me ask you this. Let's say that the trial court does a quick accounting, one page, written motion, here's what we've done with the trust. Trial court signs it, case is dismissed. Corpus is distributed, and 6 months go by, and the plaintiff finds out that, oh, perhaps there was some mismanagement. Are they then precluded from bringing suit for that?
Great question, Your Honor, because the answer is no. Restatement Section 220 that they're trying to rely on, Comment A, says that if you obtain an accounting, an approval by a court, by fraud or misrepresentation, the accounting can be reopened. And those are one of the allegations that we're raising in the 93rd District Court. Comment D says that if you get an accounting that is rendered without adequate notice and without due process of law and without compliance with the state's...
Let me just stop you there because I'm a little bit confused. Fraud and misrepresentation would imply to me that the trial court needs to do more than just rubber stamp some transactions.
Absolutely.
Well, but I believe that's working at cross purposes with my question. My understanding of an accounting was just a statement, like a statement of account. It doesn't necessarily mean that the investments were good or there was not misdealing or whatever. It's just a plain vanilla statement. It doesn't get into the qualitative analysis.
And my answer, Justice O'Neill, would be that if a beneficiary is able to question and litigate whether those statements are valid, then those issues might be decided. Where the beneficiary doesn't have a chance to do that, though, the accounting can't foreclose those claims. And that emphasizes one point that I really don't want to leave this morning without stressing to the court. No matter what you decide about the jurisdictional issue, the denial of notice, of 45 days notice, as required by due process, as required by Rule 245, as required by the 14th Amendment, simply cannot be overlooked here. Whichever court had jurisdiction, we had a right to sufficient notice and an opportunity to be heard, and that was denied.
Well, let me ask you a question. If I understand the facts, were the one that requested the trust to be terminated after they had filed their intervention and asked to be released and for an accounting to be made. Is that right?
Well, we had filed a motion to terminate before they filed the declaratory judgment motion. Then we set it for a hearing. Is that Your Honor's question?
Yes.
That's
and
right.
Then, at that hearing, their countermotion was heard, too.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor.
And
if you're willing to say...
It was stated by your opposing counsel that there was no motion for continuance based on a 45-day notice.
And that's not correct. And if I may, I'll answer
both of those.
Is there
a written motion for continuance
Absolutely.
In this record?
Absolutely, Your
on
Honor.
On that ground?
Clerk's record?
Where can we find this?
Clerk's record, page 248 and 249. Motion for continuance based on Rule 245 that was filed on the morning of March 13th. Now, we appeared for the hearing on March 11th, objected on the record, and you'll find that Volume 5 of the reporter's record at page 15 and at page 115 on the basis of Rule 245. At the end of the hearing that day, the judge said, I'm going to continue this hearing until Friday. File anything else you want me to consider. The morning of Friday, March the 13th, we file objections to the declaratory judgment motion that raised Rule 245. That's at pages 214 and 216 of the clerk's record. We filed objections to the order that had been tendered by the bank, objecting on the basis of Rule 245. That's at pages 258 to 260 of the clerk's record. And we filed a motion for continuance, which I've already cited to the court. And I would remind the court that in the seminal case on this issue, the Peralta case of the United States Supreme Court, the court said a denial of fundamental due process was preserved by a motion for rehearing after a bill of review, after the default judgment, because notice is so fundamental.
But that was the garnishment case, wasn't it, where the judgment defendant was not given any notice?
That's correct, Your Honor. But
it was not in court in any way, which is a little different than this situation.
Well, but Your Honor, we objected on Rule 245 every time we came to court. There was no doubt that we were objecting that we had been denied adequate notice. We had no chance to prepare for this trial.
One follow-up on that point. On the March 11th hearing?
Yes.
That objection, was that verbal or written writing?
The March 11th objection is oral, and it's at page 15 and page 115 of the reporter's record.
And was there a order from the judge as to your oral motion?
There is not a written or I don't believe there's even an express order. I think it's plainly implicitly overruled, though, under Rule 33. We object. We say, you can't go forward. We haven't had enough notice. The judge goes forward in the face of those objections and renders judgment. That's exactly the circumstance that the implicit overruling statement of Trap 33 is intended to redress.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If we can pick up just where Mr. Post left off, I am troubled by the fact that there does not appear to be any discovery allowed to Mr. Vargas to pursue his claims prior to this hearing. How do we address that?
Mr. Vargas did not request discovery. You are not, I certainly agree that he might have been entitled to seek it, but he did not request it. In this connection, Your Honor, I might also point out from a fairness perspective that Texas State Bank's exhibits and proof in this regard were its annual accountings that had been providing to Mr. Vargas, both Mr. Vargas and his attorneys, on numerous occasions throughout the years. They were annual accountings. I might add that this was not simply a little one-page affair. Rather, those accountings encompassed some two volumes of the exhibits.
And what kinds of information are contained in an accounting?
In this particular instance, Your Honor, it tracks every expenditure made by the trust. It cites the trust assets going from something less than $2 million at the end of 1989 to $4.5 million. And there will be, my recollection is, an entry showing the express expenditures made, exactly where the money was held, what the interest rate was, and those types of things.
Is that part of our record in this
case? Yes, it is a part of your record.
Then let me ask you this in that regard. I mentioned to Mr. Post some of the findings that the trial court made in its order.
Yes.
Were those findings required by law? With the findings with respect to the trustee's conduct and management of the trust.
Your Honor, I don't know that they were required to terminate the trust, but I believe that that is something that the trustee reasonably can request and is entitled to under the Texas Probate Code.
So he takes the position that you all overreached. Can you give us any authority for what we should expect of a trial court in an order that renders final, that with respect to a final accounting and termination of a trust? That's critical.
Yeah, Section 115.001 of the Code indicates that a trial court does have the authority to require an accounting and to settle final accounts and to surcharge the trustee, as we've already discussed. That is important to trustees who are being asked to serve as a trustee under one of these trusts or under any trust, because the trustee, although certainly is acting in the duties of to the benefit of the beneficiary, has its own interest to a degree to look after, and the trustee may well want to go to the trial court to get approval of various expenditures that's happened in this case and to receive a final accounting and approval of its accounting.
But this also went beyond that, though. It included statements about the investment philosophy was sound and The trustee acted properly and appropriately in managing the funds, which is a little bit different than just the actual looking at.
I don't believe, however, that accounting is merely a question of addition or subtraction. Accounting, if you look at the definitions that we provided from Black's Law Dictionary, for example, an accounting is a rendition of an account, either voluntary or by order of the court. In the latter case, it imports a rendition of judgment for the balance ascertained to be due and bank repayment of the amount due. In addition, if you go to the restatement of trust, which we've talked about before, they talk about that where a trust is administered under the supervision of the courts of the state, which we believe that this one was, these courts have jurisdiction not only to determine the interest of the beneficiaries in the trust property, but also to determine the extent of liabilities, if any, incurred by the trustee to the beneficiaries in the administration of the trust.
Is this order typical of what we would see coming out of the trial courts in Texas on a final accounting and termination of a trust, or is it an unusual order in terms of its extent, the extent of its findings?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. I'm not aware of any survey throughout the state. I can tell you that it would be typical of a case where my law firm serves as a trustee, because this is something that a trustee wants.
I bet they do.
Well, and again, I believe from a policy perspective that this is something that a trustee is entitled to look to the court for. It's something that is provided for by the trust code, and the trustee, in order to preserve its rights and get it adjudicated by the court.
Let me move you forward then. On the 45-day notice, is that an automatic abuse of discretion if the trial court refuses to grant, where the record shows there is not 45 days notice for a trial? Is an abuse of discretion for the trial court to refuse to grant the continuance?
I don't believe that it applies in this case, Your Honor, but if it was, I don't believe that it was.
What else would the record have to show to demonstrate the trial court erred in refusing to grant the continuance?
I think it would have to demonstrate, for example, that the plaintiffs did not request the hearing, for example, which is what they did.
Request a hearing?
Request the hearing at issue.
Maybe I'm not being clear. Let's assume that what gets set for hearing is a motion to compel discovery, and the other side comes in and files a motion for summary judgment that doesn't give the amount of time necessary, the 21-day notice. Could you defend on the notion, well, they set the hearing, so they don't get the 21-day notice on the subject matter of our hearing?
Their waiver is an issue that is allowed under the 45-day notice rule, and we've argued that that's necessary.
And so what you're saying in this case, because Mr. Vargas set for hearing a notice to have his competency, I guess, accepted and therefore declaring an end of the trust, you don't have to give him 45 days notice on your claim that would dispose of any negligence claim he had against the trustee?
We would have two answers, Your Honor. The first one is that I'm just not aware of anything that would indicate that this type of hearing is something that comes within the trial within the purview of Section 245. But in addition, Your Honor, where you have the type of situation where the relief requested by both parties is interrelated, it is all tied to termination of the trust and things that should be heard at one time. Where you have that, and where I don't believe that the motion for continuance, at least by my indication, wasn't filed until the 13th after the evidence. Perhaps there was an additional one that I'm not aware of. But in that particular context, I don't believe that the 45-day notice rule here should be an issue.
Quick question. The accounting definition you were just reading, what does that come from?
The one that I was just reading comes from Black's Law Dictionary, and it is cited in...
Oh, no, but I thought you went on. Was it in the trial court's order that talked about...
I went on to quote the restatement of trust, Your Honor, that may be which that you are referring to.
Okay.
And that is also
the trial court's order that created this trust, was that agreed? Was the bank appointed as an agreed trustee? And
there was a trust instrument, which is a contractual document, and the bank was a party to that, and yes, the bank did agree to serve as trustee.
No. I mean, did Mr. Vargas agree?
Yes, it was a contractual document that, yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments today in this special session of the Supreme Court of Texas at the University of Texas Pan American. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
Please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned. Thank you very much for your attention this morning, ladies and gentlemen, and for your attendance. This concludes our proceedings here today. Again, thank you so much for inviting the court.